Well, I want to thank everybody for being here this weekend. You've done such a great job paying attention, and I'm so impressed and grateful for the singing. The song leaders have been very intentional in the songs they've selected, and you all have sung out really well. Thank you for that. The prayers have been heartfelt and moving. Thank you for that. Y'all are doing something great here, and I pray that God blesses you as you continue to work together as a congregation here. And if you're visiting, thank you for being here tonight. I think we've had guests almost every service, and I know the congregation here appreciates that. I appreciate that. So thank you for taking the time to come out. We've been talking about the life of Jesus during this really short weekend workshop, and we started on Friday night, and we're here to Sunday evening. And I don't think you can talk about the life of Christ without talking about his crucifixion. And so we want to make sure that we take the time to do that well tonight. Part of the reason we had the switching of the computers, the last several times I've done this workshop, what I've tried to do is use the last lesson to get back into the Bible even more. You know, people come to see the videos and see the places that we've gone. But what I want to make sure to avoid is videos are helpful. They're not essential. Videos help, but they don't replace God's word. And so in the past, the last lesson, I just focus on what the text has to say and share some things. But I think you all kind of already get that principle. So I'm okay sharing another video tonight. So we're going to do that. So when we talk about the cross, just like Brett mentioned, you think about what lessons do I learn from the cross? And we should think about love. What does love really look like? What is love? And if you just go to a dictionary definition, you'll see something like this. Love is a noun that describes an intense affection for another person based on personal or familial ties. So I feel a feeling toward you because of how close I am to you in my relationship or my family relationship. The second definition is a deep tenderness, affection, and concern felt for a person with whom one has a relationship. So it's the dictionary definition has to do with the ooey-gooey, like I feel good toward you right now. But if anyone's had any traction on the tread of their life, they understand you don't always feel ooey-gooey toward everybody all the time. I love my kids. There are times I don't feel ooey-gooey toward my kids. And I know my kids love me, they tell me all the time, but I know there are times where they're like, Dad, I'm not happy right now. So there's got to be more to love than just this superficial dictionary definition. If you were to ask a child, someone shared this, and I thought it got a little bit closer to biblical love. Someone approached a kid and asked, what is love? And the kid answered, love is when a puppy licks your face. If you're a cat person, that doesn't do it for you, I'm sorry. But that wasn't all the child said. He followed up with, even after you've left him alone all day. He's understood something that love goes a little bit deeper and goes beyond just what someone might feel or express when they're happy with you all the time. It goes beyond that. So what we want to do is we want to talk about the love of Christ as we see it in the crucifixion. And what we don't often do is we don't often take all of the gospel accounts of the crucifixion and put it together in a cohesive whole to see what the sequence is. You know, what was the chronology of that last day? And what were the stops along the way? And what were all of the things that Jesus said from the cross? And so we want to take a moment and do that this evening. So just for a moment, let's talk about the chronology of Jesus' last day. Jesus' last day. What you start to realize is that there were six trials. Six trials that began with the night of his arrest when he was taken to Caiaphas's palace or Caiaphas's house, which they believe they know where that is. That's a place you can actually visit in the old city of Jerusalem. I've been there 3 or 4 times. It's at Caiaphas's house where Peter follows and goes into the courtyard. It's at Caiaphas's house where he denies him 3 times. It's at Caiaphas's house that Jesus and Peter see each other, and Peter, consumed with guilt, starts to weep and he hears the rooster crow. But that trial started at Caiaphas' house. He's actually interviewed by Annas and Caiaphas, so 2 trials, the night of his arrest. And then what the Bible does not describe, the Bible doesn't describe what happened to Jesus in the hours of the night after those interviews and when he's finally taken to the Sanhedrin. And then he goes back and forth between Herod and Pilate. And so you need to imagine, they have been keeping Jesus awake all night long. He was beaten the night before. He was in false trials the night before, and then he starts his day off and has four fake trials all before 9 a.m. He's exhausted, and he's hurting. Between the hours of 6 and 9 a.m., the Roman guards start mocking Jesus. And like our brother prayed, you have the beating, you have the scourging, you have the purple robe thrown over him. And you have to remember, Jesus at this point is a mess. Like during his garden prayer, he started sweating great drops of blood, so his skin is already tender from that experience. And then he was beaten and hurt the night before at Caiaphas's house. And then he's scourged, his back is scourged, and then they put a robe on him. And so that robe, not to be graphic, but that robe would get soaked with the blood. And they crammed the crown of thorns on his head and hurt him more. They beat him and they give him a fake scepter. But then eventually they rip that robe off. That's going to hurt. As they put his rough garments back on top of him. So they've been abusing Jesus from 6 to 9. And then finally, Pilate turns him over for crucifixion. And the Jews say, no, we can't do this. And so Pilate turns him over to the Roman guards to take him up to crucify him like a common criminal. But due to blood loss, he can't even carry his own cross very far. Simon of Cyrene has to help with that. And so shortly before 9 a.m., he starts traveling from the palace of Herod the Great to Golgotha, where he's going to be crucified. And that route, you may have heard the Via Dolorosa. It's a Latin term to describe the route that Jesus would have taken in Jerusalem to Golgotha. And there are a lot of historical ideas of what that route was. There are a lot of traditional ideas about what that route was. Most historians acknowledge that those routes are based off of tradition and ideas, not really fact. Some of the stations of the cross are not even recorded in the Bible, but they've made it into that route. So most people acknowledge that the palace that Herod and Pilate were staying in is underneath the Tower of David. You can actually go visit and see the remains of that palace. It's actually in some of our videos, so go watch that because that's really impressive. But he would have been taken from that palace and taken a route similar to this to Golgotha, to Calvary. It was not very far away. And Simon of Cyrene would have helped him carry his cross there. And so to try to help you get a picture of what that may have looked like, we've got this video clip, and this is where we're going to test technology again. This is a little bit longer video. I think it's about 9-10 minutes. And once that's done playing, I'll have a little bit more to say.
Barry, where are we right now? We're in
the
courtyard from the Church of
Olives. Maybe. Okay, Brett. Oh, I know what's going on. Yep, I've got it, because that's me, not you. All right.
Barry, where are we right now? We're in the courtyard in front of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in the Christian quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. This is the traditional location of where Jesus died and was buried, and of course, where he rose from the dead. When Constantine became emperor of Rome in the 4th century, he established Christianity as the religion of the Roman world. And his mother made a trip to Israel for the sole purpose of trying to identify locations associated with the life of Jesus. She would ask the locals, and this is where everybody said those events took place. And it was also noteworthy that the Romans had basically demolished that area to a degree because they knew of the importance that spot held to Christians.
cultural cleansing is not a new concept, and so when the Romans came through, they tried to remove those locations and reminders of things that they didn't want the people to associate with Jesus. So this structure behind us is on top of those locations.
It is.
Is there anything special that we need to do when we go in?
Well, we need to observe reverence when we go in, so we'll remove our hats.
Okay. I think one of the things that will catch anybody who visits the Church of the Holy Sepulcher for the first time is when you walk in through that double door, the very first thing that you see on the floor is the spot where they say they prepared Jesus' body for burial. And that specific rock is not the rock. That rock has actually been replaced several times because it's been worn down for people touching it and kissing it and placing things on it. If you can stand in that entrance way and try to use your imagination and remove the ceilings and remove the walls and just look at heights, to your right, where the cross would have stood, is a hill.
We climb up these steps here to an elevation a little higher than the rest of the building here. And we're standing in front of the traditional location of Calvary, which is where they believe Jesus Christ was crucified. And underneath the glass behind us, what you see is some exposed bedrock, and what they believe is that this is where the cross actually went into the ground.
So this is the traditional location where Jesus was crucified with the ladders on either side of him. It would have been very, very visible to have those three crosses there. The floor that you reach by those stairs is not very large. You can't fit a large number of people up there. So if you imagine those floors are gone, it shrinks the area where those crosses were. It really makes it plain that Jesus' crucifixion was a public crucifixion. They were making an example of these men. They were taunting him and taking advantage of the fact that he was finally stuck and he was exactly where they wanted him to be. And so there was a huge lack of respect shown to him by those who were there.
Again, we can't say for certain that is the exact spot. My personal opinion is this is the general location.
Right.
And whether or not these specific spots are exactly where, I don't know.
And the topography over time has changed. I mean, originally this was a hillside, and now you've got this large structure on top of it. To imagine Jesus and Simon carrying that cross, coming outside of that city wall, coming down to Golgotha, and having his cross placed here, and then at the finale of the crucifixion, having his body removed and placed in the tomb down beneath us.
Right.
And what most people don't realize is how close this spot is to the Rock of Anointing just below us, and then the edicule over the tomb where Jesus was buried. And we're talking less than a football field to contain all three of these locations. They're really close.
The scriptures even tell us that in the area where he was crucified, there was a garden.
Right.
And so this is a very close location. Just around the corner over there, the same building, is the edicule, which is the traditional location where he was buried.
We were able to talk to somebody at the front door,
yeah,
and we weren't sure how much we were going to get, but they're trying to work it out so that we can go down inside by ourselves for just a couple of minutes, which is a huge honor.
Yeah, it is. And what they refer to as the edicule here is this huge building that's inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and it sits on top of the traditional side of the tomb.
So it's a superstructure over to protect whatever is left.
They've actually done some renovations here. For the first 10 years, there's not scaffolding and brackets. They took all that down about 3 or 4 months ago, and so it's actually really beautiful now.
Until then, you didn't have a clear view of the edicule itself.
Right.
Thinking about the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. The resurrection of Jesus is the cornerstone of Christianity. And so to be in a place that traditionally marks that event is enormous.
Yeah, very special. Very special.
Doing my research about the edicule, every time you see pictures of it or videos of it, it is jam-packed, crowded. I mean, there are people that will wait for hours trying to get in there for just a couple of seconds.
I have visited the Church of the Holy Sepulchre probably 8 or 10 times, and I have never been able to go inside the edicule. And the reason is exactly that. There's usually a line of hours to get in there.
We were really blessed to go just before one group started their time at the entrance of the edicule, and we were told to wait, that as soon as they were done, there would be this brief window of time. So we just stood there, and we waited, and we watched them perform their service, and after a few minutes, we were finally allowed in, but we took as much time as we could to try to soak in as much as we could of the space.
Yeah.
when you first walk in, you go through a door into a square room, and in the center of that room is a pedestal with a glass case. And what I understand is that the rock inside that glass case is supposed to be a remnant of the rolling stone that actually closed the tomb. And directly opposite the entrance is another smaller door that leads into a much more confined space.
Okay, Jeremy, we're inside the aedicule, and this right here, this flat slab, is where they believe they laid the body of Jesus Christ after he died.
Now, this slab is on top of what remains of that. We don't see any original rock left.
No, the original caving and everything was long gone, centuries ago. It was destroyed. But they built this aedicule over this area to help protect it. This spot was established by Queen Helena in the 4th century when she came here. And the people of the area said this is the location where it took place.
The tomb that his body would have been laid in would not have been large.
No, it wouldn't have been large.
It was very much similar to the Church of Nativity, where everything is protected and you have the structure built over the top of it. But you still get the idea of I'm going underground, and there's a shelf here where a body would have gone. And it's just around the corner from a hill where a cross would have been placed. And that was just really special. It's hard for people who aren't familiar with first century burial practices to picture what a first century tomb would have looked like. And frankly, going into the aedicule doesn't help a whole lot with that. But Barry knew that there was a place just on the backside of the aedicule where we could go and see an example of first century tombs.
And that location of the tombs is important and gives more credibility to the location of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Okay, Jerry, we crawled into a hole here back behind the aedicule Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But I wanted to show you these niches in the rock here. These are first century Jewish tombs. What's significant about this is that we are literally 20 feet from where the aedicule is. And so that shows that Jewish people buried people in this area.
You can see how a body would be placed inside each one. You've got the chisel marks where they carved it out. And as opposed to the aedicule, you can actually see the natural rock. You can see what it would have looked like. Now, from what I understand, after about a year of a body laying in here, they would bring it out, and then they'd put the bones in those small bone boxes, the ossuaries.
And it would be reburied again.
Seeing this helps us to imagine what it would have been like when they placed Jesus' body in the tomb. They would have placed his body in, they would have rolled a stone in front of it, and closed it off.
Right.
There are a lot of times where the location is really important. Even in the Old Testament, God specified a place for his people to worship, and it was in Jerusalem. When you go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you see people from all over the world coming to this place, and it's important. But I think it's important to remember what Jesus said to the woman at the well. There's going to come a time very shortly where it wasn't in Jerusalem or in Samaria where you would worship God, that God was looking for people to worship him in spirit and in truth. It's not the location. And after his death, burial, and resurrection, and especially after Pentecost, Jesus provided a way for worshipers of God through him to worship anywhere. And I think it's important to remember that.
I enjoy taking people to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and I enjoy trying to help them understand what the building is and what probably happened there. After we walk through the building, I always try to bring people outside and gather them together and try to remind them that this isn't just a tourist stop. There's a very important events that happened in this location. They're the most important things that ever happened in the history of mankind.
From the creation of the world going forward, this is what all of history was working towards. And from our perspective looking back, it's all been influenced and shaped by that. To say that the crucifixion and burial and resurrection of Jesus was the pivotal moment of history is not an exaggeration.
Thank you. Was that worth including?
Okay.
thank you for letting me do that. Thank you for letting me share that. So one of the things that really stood out about being there, like we mentioned, was just how close everything was. As far as the spot that's the traditional location of the crucifixion with the crosses, to where the body was prepared, to where he was buried, you're not talking very far. I mean, it's less than 100 yards from one end to the other. And I hadn't pictured it that way in my head until we went there. And so that was helpful. And we kept using the word edicule. And I was sitting there going, I think we've said edicule 20 times. Edicule simply means a small shrine. So that small box-like structure underneath the dome, that box structure, that shrine, was the edicule. That's what we're talking about. That was constructed to protect the place where Jesus' body was supposedly laid. So when you get back to the chronology of Jesus' crucifixion, Simon of Cyrene helps him get to Golgotha. And then while he's there, he starts interacting with the people that are mocking him. And you have people objecting to the title that Pilate has given him as the King of the Jews. And then shortly after 12 o'clock, you have 3 hours of darkness. And after those 3 hours of darkness, the text just says Jesus breathed his last. Jesus passed away. He expired faster than anyone expected him to. You know, it was coming up on the Sabbath, and so they were rushing to break the legs of the other two men being crucified to make sure they died and they weren't putting people to death over the Sabbath. But when they got to Jesus, he was already dead. And that's when they used the spear to thrust into his side and make sure that he wasn't still alive. But that phrase, Jesus breathed his last, I actually asked my wife, is this part of the sermon that we need to include or not? She said, you need to include this. So it's my wife that got the final call on this one. But that idea of Jesus breathing his last, I want to use that to think about Jesus and what he said on the cross. You've probably heard that there are seven phrases, seven statements that Jesus made from the cross. And I want to review those just for a second and make a point and tie that into the concept of breath. Okay? So in order, in the sequence, what you have in Luke 23, 34, the first thing that he says after being on the cross is asking God to forgive the people that are crucifying him because they don't know what they're doing. And so you have Jesus demonstrating a spirit of forgiveness. Where did that come from? Well, we've been talking about lessons of love from the cross. Jesus loved even the people that were crucifying him, actively putting him to death. And he was asking God to be patient with them because they didn't understand or fully comprehend what they were doing. And then you have the interaction of Jesus with the men being crucified on either side of him. And what we know when we put the whole piece together is that you've got both of them at the beginning who are mocking him. But at some point, one of those criminals stops mocking and tells the other one to stop. Because he's convicted. He understands. Jesus is here as an innocent person. We're not. And so he turns to Jesus, and what Jesus ends up saying toward that man is, truly I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise. That came from a place of love for that man. And then Jesus, while he is being hurt and while he is dying, looks out and sees his mother and the disciple whom he loved, John, standing nearby, and he said to his mother, woman, behold your son. And then he said to the disciple, behold your mother. What was he doing there? He was actually performing the role of the oldest child, the oldest male child in the family. Because Joseph, his father, is already gone and out of the picture. At some point, we assume that he passed away. And so Jesus is the one who has been making sure that his mother has been provided for and taken care of. But he's dying. And so before he dies, he transfers that responsibility to one of his close associates, John. So even though he's hurting, he's making sure that his mother's needs are going to be met. Why did he do that? Because he loved her. And he was taking care of her. And then in fulfillment of prophecy in John chapter 19 and verse 28, he talks about, I thirst, I'm thirsty. And so they get him something to drink. And then as he experiences the consequences of the crucifixion, he says in Matthew 27, 46, my God, why have you forsaken me? And there are all kinds of ideas about what he actually meant by that as he quoted one of the Psalms. And that's something for y'all to study. I'm sure you have before. My personal opinion is he means exactly what he says as he bears the weight of the sins of the world. And then, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. He's expiring. He knows his physical life is coming to an end. And then in John 19 and verse 30, he says, it's finished. It's finished. But I want to make a point here. And we tied this into the idea of he breathed his last. And I want to talk about breath for a second. I want to make two points about breath. Air, everyone, I'm going to say something really profound. Air is essential for life. Right? We've done that a couple times this weekend, make a really profound statement. Air is essential for life. It just is. Think about back in Genesis when God creates Adam and he breathes into him the breath of life. We're not going to live without air. We have to have that. Now, the second thing that I want to point out is that you cannot speak without air coming over your vocal cords. It's impossible. I mean, you can test it, and you can really test it when you use certain sounds like H's, hello, and you feel that puff of air come across your hand. But if you try it and have your kids try it, put their hand in front of their face and try to say anything without any air moving, it's impossible. And then tell them to stop so they can breathe again. Now, why is that important? Air is essential for life, and air moves when you speak. Why is that important? Because Jesus was dying from asphyxiation. He was dying from asphyxiation. Because as he was held up there with physics, he was suspended, and as he relaxed, air was trapped in his lungs. But in order for him to exhale, he'd have to shove himself up and shove his back up the cross to exhale and take in fresh air before he dropped back down and got stuck. So every time he spoke, he had to shove himself up, speak, and then drop. Every time. Why was he willing to do that? Because he was loving people. Every statement cost him pain. But he was willing to do that because he loved people. He loved the people that were crucifying him. He loved his mother. He loved the man who had been mocking him just moments before. And he was willing to endure that because he loved us. But then he breathed his last. He breathed his last. Sometime between 3 and 6 o'clock that day, Pilate verified the death of Jesus. We mentioned the spear. And before 6 o'clock, because at sundown, the Sabbath would have started. And so they were hurrying to beat the sun going down. Sometime before 6 o'clock, Joseph of Arimathea buried Jesus in a brand new tomb that he had carved for himself. No body had ever been placed in it before. And then sometime between Friday and Saturday, the Jews posted guards on the outside of the tomb. Because they knew the disciples had heard Jesus talk about in 3 days. And so they're like, look, we need to make sure that they're not going to steal the body away. And so they posted guards with Pilate's permission. And so let's talk about 5 perspectives on the cross. From different groups that were there, different individuals that were there. The first group that I want us to think about is I want us to think about the Sanhedrin. I want us to think about the religious leaders, Annas and Caiaphas and their friends. What was their perspective on the crucifixion of Jesus? They had won. They had kept Jesus from stealing their authority. They had kept Jesus from taking their power and influence. They had finally gotten this rabble-rouser out of the way. They would have been excited to know and have confirmed that Jesus was dead. The second perspective is that of Pilate. Pilate would have been rattled by what had happened that day. he was afraid a riot was starting, and that that word would get back to Rome, and that he would possibly lose his life because he allowed a riot to start in the area that he was responsible for. I think there would have been some relief that he had survived to rule another day, but he had to go home to his wife, who had told him to leave that man alone. No man wants to do that. So Pilate would have been rattled. Think about the disciples and how they felt. I mean, Peter, just the night before, had been willing to draw his sword and actually went at that priest's servant's ear. They were trying to defend Jesus. They thought that Jesus was going to be the leader of this messianic kingdom ushering in into Palestine, and they're watching the man that they've been following for three and a half years as he breathes his last. And they're like, that's the end. That's the end. We thought he was the Messiah, but he's not. The women. I love those women. There's a lot that they didn't understand. But after the body is removed, it's the women that follow to figure out where the body was put. It's the women who go back after the Sabbath to make sure his body is prepared appropriately. It's the women. They would have been hurting, but they were going to make sure out of their love for Jesus that his body would get a proper burial. And then you've got the centurion who watches the whole thing. He watches Jesus die. The ground shakes. He witnessed this abnormal three-hour darkness. And he says something about Jesus. Truly, this was the Son of God. There was something unique about this man. That's a profound statement in Luke 27:54. Well, let's talk about another perspective. We've talked about those five perspectives. What about God's perspective on the crucifixion? And God's perspective was that of love. We had read for us already, John 15:13, greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. It's not just some emotional thing that we experience that comes and goes. Jesus demonstrated biblical, sacrificial, selfless love by laying down the ultimate thing he could lay down, his life, for everyone else. And so really quickly, I'm going to make 5 points, and I'll share the passages. But let's talk about 5 things about biblical love and what it is and what it does. Based on 1 John 4:19, John wrote, we love, he's talking about Christians, we love because he first loved us. And from that, we can understand that biblical love initiates. Biblical love initiates. You think about Romans chapter 5, while we were yet sinners, right? While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. We weren't worthy of his love. We didn't earn his love. We were actually hostile toward him, but he still initiated and loved us, right? And that leads us into the second. Biblical love is a decision. It's a choice. It's a decision of your free will. I'm going to choose to do what's in somebody else's best interest. And so in Romans 5, 6 through 11, especially verses 6 through 7, while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person, one would even dare to die. But God shows his love for us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. They made a choice, right? Without the guarantee that we would respond. You know, let's apply this to dating for just a second. Like, I'm going to get on a little soapbox because I've got 2 daughters. You know, they're 9 and 2. And so I don't know when I'm preaching and going around if I'm, like, preaching to my future sons-in-law or something. So I'm going to start now. All right, look. Biblical love initiates, and biblical love is a decision. So who calls who first? The guy. Okay? I don't want some kind of like song and dance trying to get my girl to be the one to put herself out and initiate. I'm not going to do that. Right? There's risk involved with initiating, and God chose to risk that. So you really think you might kind of sort of like my daughter? You're going to pick up the phone, son. Or you're going to text or whatever. Biblical love initiates, and biblical love is a decision. 1 John 3:18. It's not just that. John said in 1 John 3:18, little children, let us not love in word and talk, but in deed and in truth. The idea is biblical love acts. It does something. It's not just a profession. It's not just words. It's action. It's behavior. You can say that you love someone all day long, but until you actually get up and do it, you don't. Biblical love acts. And we've already made this point, this fourth point, John 3:16. Everyone knows this. Everyone knows this. For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. Think about Ephesians 5:25. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Biblical love is selfless. It sacrifices. It's giving. And you don't know if the other person's going to respond. That's biblical love. You see that in one of the best descriptions of biblical love ever in the Bible, 1 Corinthians 13, 4-8. Love is patient, it's kind, it doesn't envy or boast, it's not arrogant or rude, and it doesn't insist on its own way. I'm not thinking about me when I'm demonstrating love, because it's not about me, it's about what you need. Jesus was not thinking about himself on the cross. He was thinking about all of us, and he was thinking about that centurion, and he was thinking about the guy on the side of him. He was thinking about his mother. He was thinking about the people actively crucifying him. The last person that he was thinking about was himself. Biblical love is selfless. And then finally, John 13:34. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. John 13:34. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. What's interesting about biblical love is it can be commanded, right? Whether you feel like it or not, you can be commanded to do it. It doesn't matter how you feel. What matters is whether you're going to, by faith, submit. A new commandment. Why is it new? Because in the Old Testament, God expected his people to love. I mean, the whole idea of love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, that's in Deuteronomy. And to love your neighbor as yourself, that's in the old law. Love one another. How is that new? You know how it became new? Because of the cross. We had a new example and a new pattern and a new person to follow. The greatest demonstration of love ever to imitate. That's what made it new. Because how John 13:34 ends, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another. That's Jesus. We're following Jesus. Paul says the same thing about loving like Jesus and being kind like Jesus over in Ephesians 4:32. And what that means is that biblical love is learned. Biblical love is learned. Because left to myself, I don't love. Left to myself, I love myself. I love myself just fine. Right? I put myself first all the time. But what I need to learn as a disciple is I need to learn to think less of myself and more of others. And that's learned. And I learned that by following the example of Jesus. It's a new command because of Jesus and what he's done for us. Biblical love is learned. I'll tell you what, I'm going to black this out for just a second. And I'm going to switch this over, Brett. I don't know that we need the audio cord right now. And we'll try to get that queued up. I hope that over the course of this weekend, looking at just these five events in the life of Jesus, that your love for Jesus will grow. And I hope that the information that we've shared through geography and history and culture and all of that has helped reinforce that Jesus was real. He is real. And that you can put faith in what the Bible says about him. And what that means is you can put faith in the claims that Jesus makes about himself. He really was the Son of God. He really was the Son of God. If you're not yet a disciple of Jesus, you ought to be. And if you'd like to become one tonight, we can help you with that. If you're a disciple of Jesus, but you've grown weak in your faith, maybe you've grown weak in your love, we'd like to help you with that too. We hope your love for Christ has deepened. If there's anybody that needs to respond to the gospel invitation, please come forward and let us know how we can help you while we stand and while we sing.